Welcome to More to Come, PW Comics World's podcast of comics and graphic novel news. Now on an irregular schedule, but we are coming back at you, and here we are. I am Heidi McDonald, the editor in chief of The Beat at comicsbeat.com, and also a contributing editor to Publishers Weekly. And what has dragged us out of our hiatus? Well, an interview with Tom Gault, the hilarious, the quotable, the refrigerator putter upper honorable cartoonist, who has a new book. So let's hope our Zoom is showing it, and it is Physics for Cats. Tom,
Great. Thanks,
welcome.
Heidi.
Yeah, how on earth did you come up with a perfect title for a book of cartoons?
Well, it's, when I do a graphic novel or a kid or my kid's book, the title is kind of part of the story. But with a collection like this, you've got all these disparate cartoons, and you have to find a title which somehow connects to them, but you're never going to find anything which ties them together though completely and perfectly. So I just try and look for one of the cartoons which has a kind of fun cat, something that'll catch in people's memory and get them excited. And this time that was Physics for Cats, because there are a couple of cartoons with cats in them. In fact, there's probably about four or five in the book. And Peggy Burns, my publisher at Drawn in Quarterly, was very pleased because she told me that books with cats in the titles are always sell well. So that's good news.
Yes, well, she must have jumped up and down, because we know that comics and cats are, they go hand in hand, or paw in hand. Do you have any theories? Why are comics about cats so popular?
Oh, I don't know. I guess maybe the type of person who likes comics is also the type of person who likes cats. Maybe someone who's quite into, maybe a bit of interiority there, and a kind of introversion, perhaps. I don't know. I don't know.
Yes, I guess it's just one of those magical rules of physics, really. Just cats and comics go together. So, well, this is science cartoons, and it is this is a collection of your comics for, now I'm forgetting the name of the journal that they're for.
New Scientist magazine.
New Scientist magazine, right? So, I'm pretty much a science dummy, but I know enough to get most of the jokes in here. So,
Good.
but some of them, obviously, if you know more about science, will be even, chuckling even harder. How you are an artist, yet you make art about science, Tom. I mean, what's your science background? Start with that.
I don't have much of a science background. I stopped studying science towards the end of high school when I focused more on arts and English and things like that. But I've kind of always been a fan of science. My grandfather was a marine biologist, and he always had New Scientist magazine around, which is a very sort of storied British popular science magazine that's been published since the 50s. So we always had it in our house. And I liked it. They've always used lots of illustration because, obviously, for certain science concepts, you can't always get a photograph. So they have a tradition of using good illustration. And I'd worked for them for time to time, making illustrations for other people's science stories. But it was really coming at it from the art angle. I was working with them, and I just thought a magazine like this ought to have a cartoon, ought to have a weekly cartoon. And I said to the editor, the art director and the editor, if you ever want a weekly cartoon about science, I'd love to try doing one. And they said yes straight away. And then I kind of panicked, because that was me then realizing I don't have any science education, and I have to make a weekly cartoon for a magazine that's read by people like me who just like science, but it's also read by a lot of scientists, not to find out about their own speciality, but to keep abreast of things happening generally. So it was a slightly terrifying, and I was worried that they would just think I was a dummy. So that was a kind of frightening start.
Yeah, right. And then but obviously you acclimated to it perfectly. I mean, I've been flipping through the, I mean, here's an awesome cartoon. Well, all right, we know a Taurus is a donut, but the Taurus, but there's so many jokes in here about CERN and what happens, and just like I said, so many different levels of the humor in here. So you must have boned up a little bit, right? Or you stay
Yeah,
current. You probably read The New Scientist.
I do, and I once I got the job, I started following more scientists on social media and subscribing to a few more science podcasts. The thing that's I think difficult, or maybe difficult isn't the word, but the thing I spend most time almost doing is not researching the details for the cartoons, but researching science in general to find things that interest me, to find the little sparks that I find interesting enough to turn into a cartoon. Because if you know what details you want, you can easily find them out on the internet. It's not finding out details, or I can ask the magazine for the details. It's finding inspiration, really. So it's more about looking at the science world and just constantly filling my little notebooks with possible weird little things which could be a cartoon.
Well, I mean, is humor an art or a science?
Well, you there's I would that's an in interesting point. I mean, I would say that initial spark I'm talking about that sets you off is kind of an art because you almost can't make it happen. You can try, but sometimes you just have to wait for that spark of inspiration to come. I've got little tricks to kind of try and get it started, but that I think is definitely art. But then the massaging the joke into the right shape and putting the funniest bit at the end, there's a definite science aspect as there is with cartooning, which really appeals to my nerdy side. I'm always that when I don't have an idea, I'm kind of miserable and annoyed. And once I have it, I'm in my happy place of drawing things on a page and moving things just a little to make them a tiny bit funnier. So the science part I really enjoy actually.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked to some other very, very funny cartoonists here at More to Come. And, you can't, I always say there's no right or wrong in humor. Like, some people do find certain things very, very funny. And maybe other people don't find things that I find insanely funny, funny. And I can't
Yes.
make them find it funny, right? And you
No.
can't, yeah, yes, you can't, yes. So it's either it lands or it doesn't. And it's
Well,
very, very.
exactly. And when I make these cartoons, I don't kind of road test them with anyone. I don't have a group of people I show them to. I just send them to the art director, and at New Scientist, they'll fix the spelling or tell me my punctuation's wrong, but they just leave me to do my own thing. And maybe that means a few of them are just weird, but I'd rather some were sort of weird misfires than I was always aiming for a sort of simple, ordinary sort of a kind of humor that couldn't go wrong. So sometimes they are just weird, and they're weird things that amused me, and maybe fewer people enjoy those. But I the magazine, they seem to accept that, and the readers seem to accept it too.
Well, of course, you were doing your cartoon for The Guardian first, right? Correct, which is a weekly comic strip, and which kind of deals with obviously broader topics, more literary topics, and kind of, I mean, that's just why I'm here at PW's beautiful library, with our Christmas decor up. I said there was no other place where I could have as a background for Tom Gold, because this is kind of you have a big library audience, I would say.
Yeah, I wish I had such a great background. To be honest, I didn't actually realize we were recording this to be shown, so I haven't even tidied up behind me, so I'm sorry about that.
Oh well, I know I should have warned you. We're experimenting with our video side, so
Okay.
you have to be video ready. I should have warned you, Tom. Sorry about that.
No, it's fine. I'd have only thought about things like the light and the hair more, but it's probably better I didn't have to think about that.
Yeah, but so let's back up a little bit. So you did go to art school, and you studied art and I believe illustration, right?
No, I went to art school and realized pretty quickly that drawing was the thing I'd loved doing since I was a small kid, was still the thing I wanted to do. I didn't want to sculpt, I didn't want to make films. I wanted to find a way to draw all day long. And so I took the illustration course at my art school in Edinburgh. But they were very encouraging of telling stories of your own rather than just illustrating other people's stories. And I think maybe unlike a lot of cartoonists, maybe older generations where cartooning was a bit frowned upon at art schools, my tutors were all very positive about it. I remember Chris Ware's Acme Novelty Library was coming out at the time, and I brought it in and showed my tutors, and they were as excited about it as I was. So it was a nice atmosphere where they encouraged us to tell stories, and that's where I first started making my very first sort of picture stories. They weren't quite comics, but trying to tell stories with pictures. And then when I finished Edinburgh, I realized this storytelling was really what I wanted to do. So I moved to London and did 2 more years at art school in London on a course where it was an MA where you really got to choose what you wanted to do. And my pitch was I want to make comics and tell stories. So I had 2 brilliant years in London sort of figuring things out, which was really a great time for me.
Yeah. Now, did you jump right away to the four panel format or the multi-panel format, I should say, the comic strip format that you used at The Guardian, or did that evolve over time?
No, when I was starting out, I was telling short stories, and I think I imagined I'd move on to doing graphic novels. And I did, but the kind of learning to make short, funny cartoons was done on the job. The Guardian had a weekly cartoon illust it was kind of half an illustration, half a cartoon on the letters page of the book section. Or the books and art section. And the art director asked me if I wanted to do that weekly. And over the first couple of years, I pretty much turned it from an illustration to a cartoon commenting on one of the letters in the page. And then the Guardian had a redesign and they gave me a bit more space. So I ended up with a space that I could do 4 panel strips, or I could do one single illustration. And I was very lucky because when I started, I really didn't know what I was doing with this short, funny format. And more of them were those weird misfires that we mentioned earlier. So they were very understanding to basically let me learn on the job with a weekly paycheck, which, as a cartoonist is an amazing thing. So I'd say it took me a couple of years to figure out what I was doing there, but then I've now been doing it for 20 years, and it's been a great thing. But it was an accident that I ended up doing these funny cartoons rather than what I'd imagined, more sort of graphic novel-y things.
Well, you're kind of the last of your kind, I would have to say, because editorial cartoonists are obviously, I mean, here in the United States, the profession is all but non-existent. And comic strips are obviously still very vibrant and still very successful. But they're just, it's not like you pick up the newspaper and you turn to Calvin and Hobbes anymore. But I mean, also you're lucky that The Guardian has had this kind of comics friendly space for a long time. Here in the United States, the New York Times is very, very much like comics. I mean, they'll have this moment of being like, hey, I guess these comics are okay, but then they go, oh, comics? So.
No, The Guardian's great from that point of view. In the magazine that my work is now in on Saturdays, there's three of us making a weekly cartoon from them just on a Saturday, and there's a handful of other cartoonists throughout the week. So they're still seem to be committed to comics, and I'm pleased. And the longer I can stay there, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. Now you have done long form comics as well, Goliath and Moon Cop, and they're wonderful. I mean, I love Moon Cop. It's such a, I mean, they're both melancholy. I would say there's a note of melancholy in your work,
Oh,
Tom.
definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Which comes out more in in the short cartoons. I guess there's less space for that sort of melancholy. I think it's in there from time to time, but when you're zipping things along and telling a story in a very short space, there isn't room for those slightly melancholy pauses or the kind of the thing I really like where something's on a border of kind of sad and funny. And I really enjoy art that's like that. And when I do make these longer stories, that seems to come to the front in a way. It's less there in the funny stuff.
Is there, when you're getting the ideas for your longer form work, is it something that is, plot driven or a feeling or a setting? I mean, what really inspires you or sparks you on those?
Well, I sort of feel with the short weekly cartoons, it really fits my personality, and I like the feeling of being a jobbing cartoonist who's filling this little space and doing it well every week. And when it comes to the longer stuff, I love making them, and I love graphic novels, it's an amazing form. But I'm not so personally suited to it, and I find it hard. And that's why I've only done two, maybe two and a half graphic novels and a kid's book. Because I don't know how to start. I need building up enough of an idea to do a whole book about it rather than a short joke. I find really difficult. So I've been playing around in my sketchbooks with ideas and thoughts and characters and bits of plot because I'm determined next year to do a new graphic novel. But I don't know. I could give young students a lecture on how to be a weekly cartoonist, and I feel it would be helpful. And I don't think I could do that with a graphic novel. I would say don't do what I do. Find another way to do it.
It's funny that the longer I'm in this industry, which is now quite a long time, the more I realize that people are good at certain things. You can't make everybody be good at everything, which sounds like a real no-brainer, but I used to be an editor and a comics editor, and sometimes you try to shoehorn people into doing things they're not good at, and unsurprisingly, the results weren't very good. So yeah, everybody has that speciality, I guess. But but let's go back to Moon Cop a little bit. Like what do you remember what the idea for it is? I mean, it's about a lonely cop on the moon, and he's lonely and he goes around and things happen to him. So it is a very simple idea, and it's really in the execution. But I mean what was the genesis for that?
It was, I was just looking at pictures on the internet, and I saw this picture of this little 1950s metal toy that was called something like Moon Battle, and it was one of those wind up tin toys, and it was a I think it was an astronaut, but he was in this vehicle, and on the packaging it was kind of driving excitingly off a cliff on the moon and firing guns, and I just thought it was such a funny idea that when the moon, none of us have been back there for 50 years or whatever it's been, and it's such a quiet place. The difference between this toy, which spoke of a kind of exciting, optimistic Futurama sort of moon, and the real quietness up there where nothing's happening. And I thought, oh, I can do something with that. And my melancholy brain just imagined this little tin toy driving around on the actual moon, where obviously there's nothing to fight or no crime. And the story kind of came from there. I wrote it very quickly as a tiny little zine, which I thought, oh, this would just make a fun little story. And then I looked at it and thought, actually, it doesn't need much more. And it could be I suppose a graphic novella, maybe more than the graphic novel, but I could stretch it out, but not in a not to fill a story, but to not to not not stretching out to fill a book, but stretching it out to make the pauses longer and quieter and the melancholy be there and just really enjoy that side of it. And I did. I like inventing worlds and imagining this slightly melancholically fading moon colony was something I really enjoyed, and I was very pleased that the book turned out well and people seemed to enjoy it.
I mean, I think that's a really perfect way to encapsulate that idea, like from the inspiration to the execution? I mean, like you said, it's not, a 300-page graphic novel. I mean, I'm sure Alan Moore would have written a 300-page graphic novel about the Lonely Moon Cop and then the aliens come and all that, whatever. I mean, he's Alan Moore, he's a genius. He would have done something interesting, I'm sure. But I it does remind me quite a bit of Edward Gorey, because he did the small books, right? And they don't, the Gashly Crumb Tinies doesn't need to be a 200-page graphic novel. I mean, that was Umbrella Academy, right? So,
Yeah, no, I'm a huge Edward Gorey fan. And that things not happening and things happening off stage is definitely something which an influence of him on Moon Cop, I would say, is definitely something. And Moon Cop also kind of playing off your expectations. You hear the title Moon Cop and you think it's going to be exciting, and then I try and make something which isn't exciting and is disappointing, but somehow in a good way. And that's maybe something a bit Edward Gorey about that.
Yeah. Well, I think it was very successful. I really enjoyed it. And but your first book was Goliath. And what was the inspiration for that one? Because that's a little bit more of a, takeoff on fairy tales, I guess, or legend.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, as we said, that's my first graphic novel, and I'd done a story for Sammy Harkham's Kramer's Ergot 7, which was the huge
Oh,
book he published, where we all did a story which the page size was that of a big old newspaper comic strip. And Sammy said we could have 3 pages, and I ended up writing a 4-page story about Noah's Ark, with his sons looking at him and thinking he was a cranky old weirdo, and not kind of believing in the whole thing. And I really enjoyed doing that. I really enjoyed playing with that Bible story and playing off the things we all know about it and finding my own way into that story. And people seemed to like that story, and I enjoyed telling it. And I thought, I wonder if there's another Bible story that I can play with. And visually, I thought, well, Goliath's great. She got a big guy. That's going to be interesting on the comics page anyway. So I looked at the Goliath story in my father-in-law's Bible and realized there's a huge gap in it. It's all about David, and Goliath's really just this monster who's mainly described by how tall he is and how much his armor weighs. He's almost like a machine. And I thought, that's great, because I don't want to retell the story. I want to retell an untold part of that story. So I had a big gap I could fill in, and I just started imagining this quiet giant who actually just wants to do paperwork, and it's his visual frighteningness is what the army wants from him. And again, once I had that idea, like with much of my work, it kind of all came together relatively pleasantly after that, because I kind of had a way into a story.
Well, again, that was a very, a wonderful, sad, funny, sad exploration of the whole idea.
Yeah.
Are
And
there any
the other great thing is I had an ending from the beginning, which is always a hard thing. And
Oh,
it's kind of
yes.
it was easier to write to, or we know the tragedy's coming, and can I maybe get the reader to forget about that for a while, and then still feel some power when poor old Goliath gets killed at the end. So that's helpful too, having an ending that someone else has given you.
Now, do you have any ideas that you're kicking around that you want to workshop here on More to Come?
No, I don't find that sort of thing helps too much. I mean, I did this children's book. You can see a poster for it there, the French version, which was a kind of fairy tale. And as preparation, I read every single one of the Grimm's fairy tales, which really helped inspire that, but also just kind of inspired me generally. So I've been thinking a lot about that fairy tale world and how you could do a story for adults in that. And it may be, I've got some other ideas, but it might be fairy tale. I don't know exactly what it will be.
Well, you know what, Tom? We're gonna let you cook.
Thank
I
you.
mean, honestly, I'm very selfish. Like, we love having the weekly Tom Gall. We love having the monthly Tom Gall. But we also like our little, graphic novelette Tom Gall. So whatever, I hope you do keep doing the mini novelettes though, because
Oh
I
no, I absolutely will. When I
yeah.
say I find it hard, I find it hard to do, and then I really enjoy the process once it gets up and going. And I going back to the Edward Gorey thing, we're saying that joy of making a story and then designing an object which helps tell that story, and the story begins from the cover, not from page one, and the whole thing is one object which tells one story, I find really fascinating.
No, it's a, I mean, the question, where do you get your ideas, is stupid, and yet it's also fascinating. There is a real process to be talked about, especially how you take the idea to the end. Well, who's your cartooning idol though? I mean, you've mentioned Gorey, and I mean, who are you, some other cartoonists that are on your Mount Rushmore?
Yeah, I mean, Gorey was a huge influence when I discovered his work. I was at art school and I basically copied his style of cross-hatching, which I guess I've maybe developed away from completely ripping him off, but it's definitely stayed in my DNA. And I guess when it comes to the funny cartoons like Physics for Cats, it's a huge influence of Gary Larson's Far Side cartoons. They appeared in our local newspaper. I grew up in the countryside in Scotland, and our local city's newspaper, the Press and Journal, had Far Side cartoons amongst, farming reports and stuff about North Sea oil, and totally unexpected place to find those absolutely hilarious cartoons. And I just, you were talking about things that you just find unbelievably funny. And even more so then, I think maybe some of the power of the Far Side has diminished because many things are that sort of weird funny. I think he's had a big influence on our humor. But then they just seemed like they'd come out of nowhere. And I was just so impressed with his ability to every day to take you back to his mad world. I mean, I do two weekly cartoons and that's exhausting. I can't imagine doing a daily. So yeah, Gary Larson was a huge influence on my short funny cartoons, and as well Michael Kupperman's Snake and Bacon cartoon. I mean, I love everything he does, but that first book, Snake and Bacon, again, I guess I was in my 20s, and it just made me laugh so much.
I mean, that's an 11 for me, man. Possibly even a 12. I think my Michael Kupperman's one of the f that book in particular is just one of the funniest things I've ever read. And
Although actually his the other one of his which made me laugh more out loud than almost any other book I've read, my wife kept saying to me when I was reading it in bed, "What are you laughing at?" And I could never explain because it was so silly. It was his Twain and Einstein
Oh,
novel.
it's
It's
brilliant.
just it, it's I
It's
keep I
brilliant.
must read it again actually, but I just it made it, I was crying with laughter at that. So he's a kind of influence who I sometimes, when I'm remembering my kind of European comics guys, I forget that how much I Kupperman stuff blew my mind in my early years of cartooning.
Tales designed to thrizzle. Oh my
Yeah.
God. Oh, the
Yeah, it's all
arrival.
great stuff.
All for me, all for Pegasus.
Yes.
And
Yes.
I again, it's just like you were. How did he make that so darn funny? It's just everything in there. Anyway, he is a genius. I don't think Michael gets as much credit as he deserves, because he is just one of the all-time, for me, for you and me. All right, we'll start our fan club here, I guess,
Yes,
right?
absolutely.
I mean, I would have to say though that there is a, I don't want to use the word glut because you can never have too much laughter. But I mean, the kind of absurdist comic strip is, very prevalent on Instagram, obviously. So there's so much of it now. And it seems to have become the form du jour, the form for our times, really.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very lucky that when I started doing my cartoon for The Guardian, it was just the right size to be shareable on the early days of Twitter. And there was nobody planned that. But it's been huge because you don't want to on social media read anything very long. So short, funny comics definitely are having a moment because it's a good because the technology kind of supports that. So in my case, it was just good luck, but it means that my work is shared in a way that pre-internet, as you say, pre-internet, it's cutting it out and pinning it on a pin board or a fridge or a door. And it's great to see it being shared all around in that way too.
To what kind of reactions do you get from your readers, though? I mean, you must have some people who you do, I mean, literally do print out and or cut out and put on their either boards, some of your cartoons. I mean, what are some of the funniest and most interesting reactions you've gotten from your fan base?
Well, I think that the most heartening ones are the scientists, because I was, as I said, I was worried about them getting the work. And through that magazine, I often get sent photos of my professor has one of your cartoons on their door. And these science professors are old school. They've got a yellowing cutout thing pinned up there. So I'm always delighted when somebody shares something like that, or when I get an email from a often if I do a cartoon about something really obscure. I did one about material science, which I liked, but it was quite an obscure subject. And almost the more obscure, the more somebody who's into that will be excited by it. So I had some very excited material scientists saying, "At last, we're getting the attention we deserve." And somebody even asked to use the cartoon as part of their very learned paper. So that's always nice to be appreciated by the people who maybe aren't into comics that much anyway. So I feel like I'm winning over fans to our cause, and also managing to make these people laugh, I guess, is it makes me proud. So that's good. And I think I'm pretty lucky in terms of sharing on the internet. I think people either seek my stuff out or see it and think, "Oh, that's cool, that's in my wheelhouse," or they just ignore it. It's not like political cartooning where it's going to enrage people. I think people are probably either enjoy it or they're just bemused and they glaze over and scroll on to something else. So I get very little negativity, which seems amazing in this world.
What a wonderful thing to hear, without negativity. Tom, you have been on the road to promote Physics with Cats. I know you were at SPX. I saw you there, waved at you. You were sitting with Mimi Pond, and I guess you toured with Mimi, right?
I had a lovely little tour with Mimi and Li Lai as
Oh,
well. The
wow.
three of us did, well, we were at SBX together, and then we did three dates together where we all presented our work, and it was really nice. I had a longer tour, parts of which were on my own, but there was a real friendly little gang on tour thing we did, which was really fun. And because our work is all the three books, Lee's book Canon and Mimi's book about the Mitford sisters and my book, they're all so different. It felt like there's no competition. We were just had this weird mixture of audience of people who'd come for different reasons, all discovering our work. So it was a fun thing.
I couldn't make your New York date because I had this other commitment that I just had to keep, and I'm so bummed about it because I that what a great assemblage of talent. I mean, wow. Talk
Yeah,
about,
they're both amazing. And I came back from that really inspired by things they'd said and the differences in the way we work. And just hanging out together on the travel was great too. So yeah, really great.
I mean, how much is feeling part of the creator community important to you? I mean, obviously, Dorn & Quarterly, does have kind of a strong stable. I know they really do nurture this, their cartoonists and their authors, but I mean, cartooning is obviously a very solitary profession. So how important is it to you to feel like you're part of a community of other creators?
I've got a funny connection to these things because because nowadays my books are published in the UK by Canongate, which is a British publisher, but that's through Drawn and Quarterly. So all my books have always been published from Canada. So I'm always at a distance. I can't pop into the publishers for a coffee and have a chat. It's as nowadays it's a Zoom call. In the old days it was an email, and I think maybe on some level, I quite like that. I quite like having this friendly community of cartoonists. When I go to France, I've got lots of friends who are there. When I go to the US and Canada, I bump into loads of cartoonists I like. But most of the time in London, I've got a handful of cartoonist friends. But it's maybe the young cartoonists in London are all out partying together, and I'm just not. But my cartooning life in London is pretty quiet. There are great people whose work I love and who I talk about work with, but more, I like being part of a creative community, but also not being part of it. I think there's a part of not wanting to be in the club, but also be in the club, which is maybe quite normal for a cartoonist.
I think that's pretty much the normal attitude towards it. I mean, it is very interesting for me, having been going to SPX for, 20 plus years. Jesus, I guess it's almost 30 years now. Yeah. But to see how the community ebbs and flows. And I mean, now, like, among the younger cartoonists, there's so much pride. And like I said, in the olden days, a lot of times cartoonists were, especially like indie cartoonists or superhero cartoon, people in that, not comic strip artists, they were always very high on the cultural totem pole. But it was more almost like a sense of like, oh, I have to explain myself, right? Whereas now it's really a source of self-esteem. It's like, oh, I'm a cartoonist and I'm part of this really cool thing. And it's really wonderful to see, for me, that kind of spirit and community building and, safety in numbers, I guess.
And I think in the, what is it, 25 years I've been since I left art school, that's definitely improved, I think. I think that even in Britain, where we're never made it to the level of France or even America, really, in terms of attention for comics outside certain places like The Guardian. Even here, it's definitely much better than it was in terms of respect and attention for the art form, which is wonderful.
Yeah, well, Tom, if anyone deserves this respect and attention, it's you, Tom Gold.
Oh,
We
thank
love
you.
your comics, we love your cartoons. They are giving us mirth, and we need so much mirth in this world. So Tom, thank you
Thanks,
so much for
buddy.
joining us here at PW's podcast, about comics. And as we always say, there will be more to come.